Parsha's name is Vayigash. What other word, it's a proper noun, appears many times in the Parsha that has the same root, or that can be seen as having the same root? How are you, Dr. Fisher? As Vayigash.
What's the root of Vayigash?
For sure, Gimel and Shin. For sure, Gimel and Shin. The Yud is questionable, but probably not even. Probably just the Gimel and Shin. Can you think of a word? That would have to have a mem. Think of a proper noun in the Parsha. I know you've all heard the name. That also has a Gimel Shin in it. It plays a very central role in the Parsha.
Goshen.
Great. Very good. Goshen. Goshen was the part of Egypt that that Yaakov and his family settled in once they arrived in Egypt. Okay, what does Vayigash have to do with Goshen?
Well, Goshen is where they...
We'll see. Yes.
This is where they
left and you went.
Opted to go to the shepherds.
Yes.
Pharaoh allowed them to go.
Yes. Now, what is Vayigash means, and he approached. Vayigash means Yehuda approached Yosef. For what purpose? Vayigash Elav Yehuda. When Judah approached, then Judah approached him. Him is Yosef. And he said, "If you please, my lord, may your servant speak a word in my lord's ears, and let not your anger flare up at your servant, for you are like Pharaoh." And he goes on to petition. The last scene of the last parsha was that Yosef had decided Binyamin has been framed. He has been caught red-handed. He has my silver cup, my silver goblet in his possession. He is a thief. The law of the land is he has to become my slave. All of you can go home in peace to your father. Binyamin is staying here. Of course, Yehuda had, in last week's parsha, had taken an oath and had basically put his own future, his eternal eternity on the line, guaranteeing to his father that he would see to it that Binyamin returns. Now Yehuda is under great pressure, because if Yosef does keep Binyamin, Yehuda is finished. And Yaakov, for all they know, Yaakov is not going to live when he finds out that Binyamin stayed in Egypt. So Vayigash refers to the approach of Yehuda to Yosef. Okay, so Vayigash, he approached Goshen, the land of Egypt that the Yaakov and his family settled in. It says in reference to Goshen, although the name Goshen appears many times in the Parsha, but in one sentence it says that Yaakov sent Yehuda, as they were all getting ready to travel down to Egypt, Yaakov sent Yehuda ahead. Let me just find that. Here it is. And he sent Yehuda ahead of him to Joseph to prepare ahead of him in Goshen. And they arrived in the region of Goshen. So Yaakov sent Yehuda ahead of the group to Yosef to prepare ahead of him in Goshen. And they arrived in the region of Goshen. What is the connection? Goshen Vayigash. Yehuda, it also says, Yehuda he sent to Yosef. It's also a meeting of Yehuda and Yosef. All right, but the word approach isn't used. It's the destination, Goshna, that they are going. What's the connection? Between the word and he approached, which is the name of the Parsha, referring to Yehuda's approach to Yosef, and the name of this place, Goshen, where the Jews settled. It's the same root.
Well, Goshen is definitely the reason he sent him ahead of time, because he could have gone down there He sent him down there to set up a seminary, a yeshiva.
Okay.
And that's the most important thing of the whole thing, if they had that in place.
Okay. Let me cite that here. What Perry is saying is the Rashi's commentary, very well known, Midrash. Judah's mission. Jacob sent Judah ahead of the family to make the proper arrangements for their arrival and settlement in Goshen. Of all his sons, he chose Judah, who was the proven leader of the family and who had demonstrated his prowess in the confrontation with the viceroy who had threatened Binyamin's freedom, because he stepped forward. Rashi cites the Midrashic interpretation of Judah's mission. The Midrash interprets Lahoros, which all it says in the English is to prepare. But the Hebrew word Lahoros means to teach, from the same root as Torah, Mora, teacher. The Midrash interprets Lahoros as to teach, which implies that Jacob dispatched Judah to Goshen to establish a house of study. This set a precedent for all Jewish history. Historically, the first priority of Jewish communities has always been Torah education. For the soul of the nation is the Torah. Without it, we are not a nation. That's what makes us a nation. That's what makes the Jewish people the Jewish people. It's been said before, it's not culture, because Jews come from many different cultures. It's not language. Many Jews speak the foreign language of their native country. It's not dress, it's not customs. There's only one thing that makes Jews, Jews. We all share the Torah. So if we're going to move the Jewish community into Goshen, into Egypt, that have an establishment of Torah there. That was Judah's mission. But still, it's interesting how, even according to Rashi, it says that Yehuda, he sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph. Why did he have to send him to Joseph? Why doesn't it say he sent him to Goshen? Why does it say he sent him to Joseph?
It's got to be something with the kingly thing that you're talking about there, because Yehuda is the tribe we're going to get the king, and Joseph, you said, is the first of all the kings.
Very
so
good.
It's got to be something.
All right. Good thing. Yehuda's a king and Joseph's a king. Very important. You know that in history,
at that point,
he just said he played the role of a leader.
As the leader.
Yes. I mean, we didn't have a formal king because there was no formal nation. But Yehuda was the leader of his brothers.
He was selfless.
Yes.
Because of owning up to what he did and all those things that he did.
Yeah. You remember things I don't even remember. The other thing to realize is that the relationship between Yehuda and Yosef continues into Jewish history. Somewhere in the book of Kings, after Shlomo, there was a split in the kingdom. Right? There became two kingdoms in Israel. Civil division. There was what was known as the Kingdom of Judah, mm-hmm. which was the original dynasty, and then there was the Kingdom of Israel. Now, who was at the forefront in the establishment of the Kingdom of Israel? And who was at the forefront is Ephraim. Ephraim is a descendant of Yosef. So you have these two kingdoms, basically Yosef and Yehuda again.
Yeah.
You're the two kings. Yehuda approached Yosef. Yehuda went to meet Yosef in Goshen to establish, to prepare the place. It's this Yehuda and Yosef team again. And then later on in history we see Yehuda and Yosef are dividing. And the whole Jewish people, the whole identity of the Jewish people becomes split between Yehuda and Yosef. So what's this with Yehuda and Yosef? Who are these people? And it really causes us to look back on the original incident. Can't forget what transpired between Yosef and all his brothers, is that there was animosity and they wanted to kill him and they sold him as a slave. And how did that happen? These are sons of Yaakov. These are righteous people. What was the source of the animosity? And we really talked about this last week. We basically said it was jealousy. But we have to look deeper than that. And the other question is, if indeed there was cause for animosity, why do we find that in this parsha, when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers, the animosity is ended? There's no aftermath. There's no hard feelings. You know, real credit to, goes to Yosef, because the brothers immediately felt, they realized their, they felt, they looked back at all that they did, and they were crushed. They were unable to answer him. It says, Yosef says, don't worry, don't feel bad. God wanted me to come here to prepare the way for the famine. So, but much to Yosef's credit, there was a reconciliation here. You know, really, you can see Vayigash as a reconciliation. He approached him. I mean, who is it that sold him into Egypt? Yehuda. Yehuda caused this dissension. You know, remember it says Yehuda left his brothers and he went to marry the daughter of the man. That's how he got involved in his family. He left his brothers. He went down from his brothers. The Rashi says that he was demoted because the brothers looked to Yehuda for an example. And if he would have said, let's bring Yosef back out of the pit and bring him back to his father, they would have listened. It's because Yehuda said, let's sell him, that they went along with selling. So really, Yehuda was the cause of this split in the first place. And all of this split, all of this divisiveness, which led to all kinds of problems. And in this week's Parsha, Vayigash Elav Yehuda. Yehuda is now coming back to Yosef, and they embraced, and there was peace. And now it's Yehuda and Yosef working together to form the foundation of the new Jewish community.
Is King David a descendant of Yehuda?
Yes.
Well, didn't it seem a little strange to be a descendant of Yehuda?
Why? Yehuda is...
Well, you said because he failed the test, so to speak.
Which test?
The one you just alluded to. And he didn't say, but
yes.
Take them out of...
Okay, so that's what I want to get to. What I want to get to is... What we have here, so these are not, you know, brothers fighting in a sandbox, okay? Over who gets to use the shovel. These are our leaders. So what was the issue of the animosity to begin with? And what was the resolution? And how were they able to reconcile?
What did you say in the
sandbox?
Sure, we can certainly, these are the symptoms. The symptoms were jealousy, the symptoms were gossip. We cannot be satisfied with an explanation that these brothers were just immature babies fighting in a sandbox. That he's tattletaling and they're jealous. You know, these are not our great patriarchs of the Torah. And what is it about Yosef and Yehuda that they are these two powers, two kings, and they become split down the road? The Jewish people are split. And don't forget, the temple was destroyed over a split in the Jewish people. So really, I don't know what the explanation is, but it is something very major here in these three parshios. That goes to the core of the way Jews interrelate. Now, when I come to this topic, and every year I come to this, this is really, to me, this is the only thing to talk about in these parshiyos, is the issues between the brothers. I always try to look for other approaches or other important issues. This always comes back to this issue. And until I find out otherwise, the authoritative work on this question is, and I've even quoted this, and I brought this to lunch and learns before, is this book, this Sefer, Patterns in Time, written by Rav Matthias Weinberg, who is the son of our the revered Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg, Zichron Lebracha, also the brother of our Rebbetzin, Miriam Feldman. I don't understand this book, believe me. It's too deep for me. But I know that he deals with the issue of Yosef and Yehuda. And let me read to you, if nothing more, but one page. And I've probably done it before. I'll probably do it again. But gives us, just opens up the discussion of where the strife is. See, let me make one more contrast. That there's been conflicts in the Torah before is well known. But the kind of conflicts we had in the past were like night and day. Yishmael versus Yitzchak. Esav versus Yaakov. These are the conflicts between literally good and evil. Between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, this world and the next world. Where Esav is totally an Olam Hazeh person. No interest at all in Olam Haba. That's why he sells his birthright, pursuit. Yaakov is very much Olam Haba. That's what he's living for. So we can understand, it's easy to understand the strife and why there would be dissension. But when we get to the sons of Yaakov, where we are taught, Mitoso Shlema, his bed, meaning his progeny is complete, every one of them, it becomes much harder for us to understand why there would be conflict. You know, these are Jews. These are all Jews. They all have the same father. They're all on the same page in terms of, you know, Olam Haba, spirituality being key. What are they arguing about? Why do they have such a hard time? Why did they go through 12 years where they couldn't live with Yosef? They literally couldn't live with him. They couldn't speak to him. What was so bad about it? So he was younger? What was the philosophical, what is the theological issue here? And we really can't be satisfied with anything less than a major theological issue. We can't be satisfied with sibling rivalry. It just won't cut it. Got to be something deeper than that.
They were afraid that they were going to all be disinherited and then everything would be Joseph's.
Okay, that's an approach.
We talked about that.
Well, why would it be that way? They were wrong about that. They were underestimating themselves. None of these men, Yehuda is the destined king, Levi is the destined priest, and Levi, these are no lightweights.
But they don't know that.
You got to know yourself. You got to know. If you know, you know. Like Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, woe is to the person who doesn't know his faults. But double woe to the person that doesn't know his qualities.
Let's see, they hadn't read the book yet.
I know I mentioned that commentary, but really, I think I always turn to Rav Matis for shedding light on it. So if I had to pick one page of this mammoth work, I would pick chapter 4.5. Excuse me, 5.4. A soul divided. Within every individual reposes a dichotomy which is constantly present to a greater or lesser degree, but which is a hallmark of the period of adolescence. On the one hand, we are driven to discover ourselves as individuals. We long to know what makes us different, how we can best express our special selves. We search for identity. We are driven towards personal freedom, towards youthful abandon, unrestricted relationships, to a celebration of the expression of individual life within a dynamic and physical Olam Hazeh. In other words, we want to be somebody. We want to make a difference. We are unique. We don't want people telling us what to do. We certainly don't want to just be a conformist and just be a cog in the wheel. That is a basic human drive. The problem, the reason why we don't all turn out that way is because we have another drive which counteracts the first one. And it's just as powerful. We have another drive no less powerful. We seek to relate and to identify with the source and the goal of life. We desire meaning and significance through relationship with the eternal, through the transcendence of self. This is a drive which demands acknowledgement of reality and assumption of responsibility. In other words, we have a drive inside of us that says we've got to belong to something. We just can't go off on our own. There's a truth out there, and I've got to find out what that truth is. And I've got to subscribe to it. And if I don't, I'm nobody. So on one hand, we seek to be individual, we seek to be independent, to be in a certain way unrestricted. At the same time, we know that we've got to be part of and subject to a greater truth, which really humbles our sense of individuality in a certain way, or at least it seems. Within us, there rages a battle. Some of the rabbis call this the battle between the klal and the prat, the general and the specific. We all have something.
What was the last?
Specific. No. General and specific.
Hebrew words.
Klal and prat.
Prat.
We're all part of the same klal. We all have the same creator, the whole same father. In one sense, we're all the same. And we're all puny. We're all, what are we? You know, what is a man? And therefore, we better find out what our mission is in life and what God expects us to do. Otherwise, we're going to fall off the track. This is an important, this means a lot to us. At the same time, we don't want to be told what to do. We want to do our own thing. Life is a constant struggle between these two poles. And peace and serenity really comes only when somebody has been able to make peace with these two realities and synthesize them in his life. Really, that's the only way to speak. That's the definition of peace. Well, there's other polar opposites too, but this is probably one of the major things. You know, how do I balance conformity with individuality? Duty with responsibility with expression. It's the battle of life. Sometimes people take one to the extreme at the exclusion of the other, because they can't make peace with the two worlds, and so they kind of just give in to one or to the other. And what happens with that is, he says, endless search for identity. If somebody just stresses the first way, it destroys hope of real accomplishment. That person's going to end up a hippie, or, you know, loss of identity. They're going to be searching so much for identity that they're not going to have one. And a lot of people are so into themselves and into self-expression that they end up being very disillusioned, and they lose. Look at all the movie stars have wrecked lives. Self-expression becomes synonymous with self-dissipation. Relationships and youthful abandon turn into obsessive needs. There are people that they ruin their lives because they want to be so unrestricted that they end up, you know, forming very dangerous habits and addictions. Ultimately, the monstrous servitude to one's own drives and habit-forming dreams becomes the worship of a golden calf, the lord of pursuit of happiness. That's a person that went off the deep end on search for identity and individuality. But the opposite drive may also lead to evil. The attraction of cults is one manifestation of the potential danger to the individual whose whole desire is to lose himself to the greater good. A person who says, I'm not important, it's the cause that's important, I'll do anything for the cause, that person could become a cult, you know, a cult person. He loses his identity. What begins as a quest for meaning ends in the loss of personal significance. And he goes, it can become worse, it can degenerate even further. So, clearly going off in other directions solely is destruction. As we said before, the struggle in life is to synthesize the two. Now, Yosef, we are introduced in his younger years, and he exhibited a lot of these qualities of youthfulness. He was called a youth, a lad. Rashi says that he was very beautiful, and he used to spend time admiring himself, combing his hair, and so forth. He was a picture to look at. Even Yaakov admits that at the end of in the blessing that he gives to his sons. He says the girls wanted to climb the walls just to get a look at you. And he had these dreams of greatness, dreams of lording over his brothers and so forth. And he was definitely, you know, you might look at him and you might say he's a rambunctious one. And the brothers were more aware of the goal, aware of the responsibility. They were older, you know, to them the most important thing was to be stable and not a dreamer, you know, do the right thing. And so Rav Matta says that basically, to make a long story short, I don't even understand the long story, but it was this struggle between Yosef and his brothers. It was the struggle between having a very, very healthy self-image and having ambition to personal accomplishment, personal project. To be, as we see, Yosef is extremely, we say in Yiddish, geschickt, extremely, what does it mean, endowed with the ability to manage a country, I mean, economy, politics, to manipulate the brothers the way he wanted to bring out a certain response. He was able to put on a show, to be able to hide his identity for the longest time. He was a tremendously powerful individual. And at the beginning, when he was a young boy, that seemed to the brothers that maybe he was headed for go off the deep end. And they could not reconcile that he would be able to represent the mission of the Jewish people because he was too much of an individual.
Does it indicate in this book or somewhere elsewhere that when Joseph was in prison for the vagrant, whatever, that he did not have faith, did he, that God would rescue him?
Ever so slightly. If we had to say who Yosef was, we would say he's a man of faith. Ever so slightly, on his level, he veered an inch, and that was to God, that was a mile. That's because Yosef was such a man of faith. We see who but a man of faith could, after all these years and all that he went through, say to his brothers, "Oh, don't feel bad. God put me here so I could keep you fed during the famine."
So he definitely gets
faith. He's the only, put it this way, he's the only of the brothers that's called Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the Righteous. Look how he was all alone. Look how he was in such a position of temptation. And he could have, you know, what did most people do in his situation? Forget it. My old world is behind me. This is a new world, not Yosef. But what the brothers didn't realize is that Yosef had totally synthesized the individual, the claw, the prot with the claw. He was a claw man through and through. He understood the mission. He understood the mission better than they did because he had also developed the individuality so much. So he was perhaps the perfect model of synthesis between the worldly and the spiritual. You know, this is something that we all struggle with. How do we synthesize the two worlds? Yosef, besides being the first king, Yosef was the prime example in the Torah of synthesizing. And by the way, he got it from Yaakov, because Yaakov also did it. But among the 12 tribes, Yosef was the perfect model of synthesizing Olam Hazeh with Olam Haba. So much so that the other brothers didn't believe that it was possible. And what happens in this parsha is that Vayigash Elav Yehuda, who is the who is the symbol of the responsibility, of the mission, of the goal, of the klal, caring for the klal, he comes to acknowledge and recognize that you need the traits, you need the individuality of a Yosef in order to play out the Jewish mission in this world. That this world, there has to be an Olam Haba and an Olam Hazeh. We cannot make it with just, we need a leadership, we need a leader who can deal with all of the vicissitudes of life. And it was Yehuda and Yosef. And Yosef always recognized the contributions of the other brothers. Because he also realized that while he was pursuing his individuality, he was working for the boss. He was working for the cause. And this is a reconciliation. This parsha is a reconciliation of the two aspects of life. The Olam Hazeh and the Olam Haba, the Klal and the Prat. And that's how Goshen was built. Goshen was a place where there was a synthesis, there was a peace. And the Jewish people literally started the nation in Goshen. It was at that moment in history when there was a complete peace between the physical and the spiritual, and it lasted for many years. And I suspect that any split in the kingdom that happened later on is because we lost the synthesis, and some Jews may have tended to emphasize more the spiritual, and the others maybe a little bit more the physical, and we became lopsided. And that's the split between Yehuda's kingdom and Ephraim's kingdom. And that ultimately what we must do, and this really fits in with Sinat Chinam, with the split, you know, unwarranted hatred. Why do people have hatred, Jews to Jews? He's too worldly. Or, he's too frum. What's happening here? Everyone struggling to find the balance, to find the synthesis between Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh. And that's a delicate balance that we're all striving for. And when we see somebody who's on the other side of things, he looks far away. And that what the solution is lies in Vayigash Elav Yehuda. Yehuda and Yosef putting their heads together and saying, "Come together, let's build Goshen." That's the explanation of Yehuda Shalach Lefanav El Yosef. Yaakov sent Yehuda towards Yosef. Go together. Lahoros Lefan of Goshna. Prepare for us the road. Yes, Yehuda is going to build a yeshiva. But Yosef is going to make sure that all of the physical plant is there. And together you're going to establish Goshen as a place of peace, as a place where the Jewish people can start. And that's the connection, Goshen, to Vayigash. Because it was a place where the two brothers finally were working together, and they appreciated and they acknowledged the contributions that each one had. And this is our life goal that we have to. It's okay to have people on the team that do different jobs. It's okay to have somebody who's a little bit more into the spiritual, someone who's a little bit more into the worldly. You don't expect everybody to do everything exactly the same. As long as we are all working for the same goal, and that we are all acknowledging the contributions of the other, then we can have peace, and we can have achdus, oneness. And this parsha, let's catch it while we're here, because this is what we're supposed to learn from the story of Yosef and his brothers, and the reconciliation, and at least that we have to preserve, because if we don't preserve it, the two worlds start to drift apart from one another, and that's when we have the tension.
Are you saying a 15-year-old brother?
Brother, yes.
Does not engender. You think him, what Yosef stood for was grandiosity at age 15 in relation to the older brothers. He didn't show his excellence that the brothers perceived. The brothers perceived an annoyance. And So I think that human nature, 15-year-old speaking to an adult who may have it all together that the adults don't.
They weren't all, yeah, they weren't that much older than, well, they could be. Could be 5, 6, 7, 8 years, yeah. Yes.
No, he was the youngest.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Not to trivialize it too much. So, we don't want to say that they were fighting over the sand in the sandbox, but to say that they didn't realize that a person who has such a healthy self-image and such a uniqueness and such an individuality can still be working for the same goal. That was a chiddush to them, and that's what Yosef really taught the world.
Did his father, did Yaakov understand where Yosef was at that time?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Because Yaakov also went through that. Yaakov also perfected it. Vayovo Yaakov Sholem Yir Shechem. Yaakov returned back to Israel, complete, to the city of Shechem. He had lived in the life, just like Yosef had developed his unique qualities and leadership in a foreign land. So did Yaakov. Yaakov had his great rooting from the land of Israel with his father, but then he spent 20 years in Gosh with Lavan and he maintained his mission. He maintained his commitment to the mission. So he understood Yosef, and that's why he picked out Yosef as the most potential of all the brothers. That's why he gave him the coat. The other brothers, not having the same degree of youthfulness and of the same degree of passion and search for freedom and so forth, they didn't think that it was possible to be as free as Yosef was and still be working for the team. And that's what Yosef showed them. He said, I'm Yosef. I'm the same Yosef that grew up in my father's house, and I've been a viceroy in Egypt. And look what I've accomplished with my strengths and my qualities and my traits. I'm still Yosef. And they were amazed that that could be. And that's when they reconciled. That's when the Yehuda said, Yosef, you've shown us a lesson that you can be very worldly and you can be fully developed in your personal individuality. And you can be on the team. Not only be on the team. See, there's a very fine line. A lot of people say, well, you can be religious and you can also be in the secular world. This is not exactly the same.
What is this analogy?
No, this model. See, this is a very big ideological statement. Let me share with you. This is something that I think was one of the hallmarks of Rav Yaakov Weinberg and his understanding. It was said about him that there are three approaches to synthesizing the two worlds. One approach is to say, Olam Haba is what's important, and Olam Hazeh is not. This is one approach. And you can look around the world and you will find people in this category. You will find people that will say, now I'm not talking about the people that say Olam Haba is not important. We're not talking about that. So they're not synthesizing. Others will, and, okay, well why, what did I just say? Why are they synthesizing? Because they're saying, okay, let me restate it. Olam Haba is what's important. Olam Hazeh, we'll have to put up with it, right? But we'll try to avoid it as much as we can. Well, it's a necessary evil.
That's the second.
That's the first. I'm restating it.
Oh, okay. We restate.
You can't say Olam Hazeh is not important at all because you got to live in it. So we'll live in it, we'll put up with it, but we're going to try to avoid it as much as possible.
Okay.
The second approach is to say, Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba. Can't really synthesize the two. They're kind of very different from one another. What I'll do is, I'll do both. I'll have one foot in Olam Haba and one foot in Olam Hazeh. Now you might say, what's wrong with that? Very good. You're able to synthesize. Is it synthesizing or is it not synthesized? It's participating in both. I can belong to that shul, and I can also belong to that shul. When I'm in that shul, I'm that kind of a person. When I'm in that shul, I'm that kind of a person. There's no synthesis. There is cooperative living. That doesn't mean a synthesis. Rav Weinberg taught that, which I think is really what Yosef is teaching us, that the purpose of this world is for Olam Haba. Purpose of this world is for Olam Haba. There's only one world. Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba are not separate and distinct. They are one. Just like the body and the soul are together. They're one. So is Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba one. So it's not that I'm doing both. It's that when I'm involved in Olam Hazeh, my entire purpose in that involvement is for Olam Haba. I know it sounds theoretical, but this is a difference in outlook.
You're sanctifying the mundane.
You're sanctifying the mundane, and the purpose of your involvement, like Yosef. Why was Yosef thinking about his hair? Why was Yosef? Why was he going out and having the ambitions of being a ruler in a foreign land? I don't know. I don't even know if he planned that. But why was he dressing up as an Egyptian? And all for one reason, because this was what was needed for the mission. Like Esther, you know, Esther. She was the queen. She wore beautiful clothing. She lived in the palace. She fought wine and died. But why? That was her mission in the role. So. Here's the question. When we participate in Olam Hazeh, we have to stop and ask ourselves, why are we participating in Olam Hazeh right now? Is it just because now is Olam Hazeh time? And later on will be Olam Haba time, and I do time sharing? Or is our purpose for Olam Hazeh always, constantly, consistently for Olam Haba? Am I doing all that I'm doing, l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven? Such a difficult thing to synthesize the two. But this is what Yosef and Yehuda, maybe originally the brothers were kind of saying, you know, you can't have both. You can't have your cake and eat it. You can't participate really in Olam Hazeh.
They were the
and
first still,
what?
They were the first.
They were like the first originally, and Yosef was like the third. The second is really just a poor attempt to synthesize. It's the first is also not complete. It's the third. That's the complete way. And this is what Yosef embodies.
Now, the other model obviously doesn't have the person who's only for Olam Hazeh is not even.
He's not even in the picture because what he's like Esau.
Yeah.
He's like, say, I forget it. I, you know, all I see is Olam Hazeh.
Yeah.
That's all I, you know, the other thing is too elusive. It's too, it's not fair. It's not concrete. That's not even on this. That's not even on this chart. And really, it surely could be. Because the first group says, Olam Hazeh is not really important either. We'll just have to live with it. You can't avoid it totally. You've got to eat, you've got to get married, you've got to... But you can do it begrudgingly, and you can look for ways to avoid it as much as possible. And you can kind of look down and scorn it. And you could say, it's a weakness, you know. But, so that's an attempt to synthesize, but not really.
Well, but why... You can. It's that. It's you can touch it, feel it, whatever.
Yeah.
The other is prevalent.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That's correct.
And so you really have to. It tests you. I don't totally understand.
Yeah, I think that's the reason for the that's why it's such a challenge. And I think we really should make it four categories. You've got Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba. So what do you do with it? Either you reject one and take the other one, or and that's kind of what Rabbi Weinberg describes as could be an unhealthy personality. You know, a person that says. All that's important is not, I'm not important, my individuality, you know, having some freedom, having some personal expression, that's not important. What's important is, you know, the goal and the, you know, the greater whole, and I'm not really a nobody. That leads the loss of personal significance. That's not a successful person. The other way to say, well, all I can really incorporate into my life is the what I can see and hear and taste. And the other one is just, you know, I'll do maybe I'll pay lip service, maybe I'll do a couple of rituals here and there. It's not really part of my life. And then there's the in between. And Rabbi Weinberg taught that time sharing is really not the right approach either. It's synthesizing the two, and it doesn't matter whether I'm learning, davening, or I'm working, you know, living with my family, etc. I'm always involved in Olam Hazeh for the purpose of Olam Haba, and that's the peaceful life. That is peace. That's synthesis. That's a Yigash Elav Yehuda. That's Yehuda giving credence and recognition to Yosef, who was able to do to synthesize that.
Are you asking us to be non-judgmental? If we're living in Olam Hazeh,
yeah,
the sister Olam Haba, everything that we do, can we not? I'm just thinking of this world, which has many people who are very observant and others, and many people who are on the way.
Yeah.
And there's judgments about where both are.
Why don't we say this? We're all in the same boat because we all have to figure out a way to synthesize our Olam Hazeh and our Olam Haba. And therefore, I respect where you're at. Now, what we do have to agree on is that we're all part of the goal. We're all part of the mission. We're all in the same team, and we all have to grow. We all have to, wherever we're at, we do have to embrace both aspects. And I think that if a person's in a war and fighting a battle, I don't think you can criticize them. You know, because everyone's in a different position in the war, but we're all fighting. When people say take the extremes, you know, we have to the main people that we have to be judgmental about is ourselves. Are we participating in the battle? Are we making strides? Have we resigned on one or on the other, or are we working towards synthesis? We've got to have forward motion. We have to appreciate other people. You know, we could say like this. Let's say I'm a person who's more material. I don't have the same appreciation for the spiritual. And I look at my guy on the other side of the bench. So rather than saying, well, he's too far off on the other side, I could say, I'll bet I could learn things from him. And I'll bet I have some resources, some talents, some ideas that probably he would appreciate. Maybe I could be his friend. And then together we could maybe grow, you know, each closer towards synthesis. So we don't have to be judgmental. We can, if we're all on the same team and we're all working towards the same goal, that's where Achdus comes in.
Well, you know, I just learned something. We talk about unity, that's one of the key words, unity of the Jewish people. But what you've taught me today is that that's fine, and that's the goal, but the goal, real goal for ourselves is to have unity of our own selves.
Yes.
It's unity.
And when people are working towards personal unity, that's when there's unity among the people too. That's it. Inner peace. Inner peace leads to outer peace.
Yeah.
That's why people say we want peace in the world, right? But we got to work. If we work on inner peace, we will. That will spread out.
Right.
Go ahead. Okay. Thank you.